Last week, we ended our study in Genesis chapter 33, so we will be picking up in chapter 34 today. Jacob was back in the land. He was residing with his family in Shechem. His family, it's including his 11 sons at this time. And the following chapters are historically difficult to translate. They're difficult because it depends on how you are approaching Scripture as to whether these chapters make any sense. And really, they're often completely skipped over altogether. And you'll see why as we go through our study today. In chapter 34, we have Jacob's daughter, Dinah, is raped by the prince of the city in Shechem. Chapter 35, Reuben, Jacob's oldest son, he commits incest with one of Jacob's wives. We get to chapter 37. You know that one well. Joseph gets sold into slavery by Jacob's other sons. And then chapter 38, Judah has relations with his daughter-in-law. So we have suddenly this story that's been following one streaming line of the seed of the woman, that promise being passed down. We saw it first with Seth, then went through that Genesis 5 genealogy. We ended up with Noah, and then Shem, Ham, and Japheth. We saw that the blessing went to Shem, and then we followed that genealogy down till we got to Abraham, and then Isaac, then Jacob. Now we have 12 sons, and the story is suddenly giving us information about each of these individual sons as it plays into the story. Now, today we're just going to focus on chapter 34 and chapter 38. And everyone, when we're coming to the Scripture, we're trying to account for the text. Why is the text the way that it is? Why is it written in this way? Why is this included in the story? I was looking online at some various sermons to see what people were saying about this particular text with their interpretive schemes. And it was, first of all, it was very slim. You want to go home and look at Sermon Central somewhere, you'll see not many are, most of the time this is just skipped over. But whenever I did find various sermons, they were coming up with things like weathering the storms in life, the consequences of sexual sin. God has included this in his story so that you'll know that it's bad to enter in these kind of sexual relations. One person will say, this story has more questions than answers for us. We wonder at its inclusion and how it is supposed to relate God to us. It makes us uncomfortable and we squirm in its presence. When we live in a world that seems overcome by violence, where we seem used to the violence all around us, why does this story trouble us so? My favorite one will say, from time to time we run across a passage in the Bible that I would call a stinker passage. It is a passage that when you read it, you immediately say, what in the world am I supposed to learn from this? And this passage would qualify as a stinker passage. This passage is not a stinker passage. I would disagree with him. I think that this passage is very necessary, as we'll find, to the story. It's included with a very central purpose to our theme. And if you've been following along, you'll probably be able to pick it out really quick as we're moving through. So, when we come to the text, what do we say? Proponents of a higher criticism, this kind of a theory that the Bible is not one continuous narrative, it is a hodgepodge of various texts just sewn together. They're going to say, it's not a unified story, it's not tracking anything. I have one here that when I was trying to find sermons, he says, Judah and Tamar, this story, perhaps from Jay, interrupts the Joseph story, which it has no connection. That's wrong. It has every connection to the Joseph story. In fact, by the time we make it to the end, next week, we'll finish up in Genesis, the Joseph story you might feel is more of a Judah story. So I hope you're starting to see in this unified story that we are following one narrative. And the narrative is about one central theme. And that theme is God's plan to reconcile a fallen creation through his son, Jesus the Christ. That's the story, that's what it's about, and it's all relating to Jesus the Christ, the Messiah. Now, when we started this story, God told us in the very first chapter his purpose for creating man. In Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 28, he is creating man to be his representative ruler, to be his image bearer on the earth. God tells us how the problem began with Genesis chapter 3 and God's rebellion against him, his refusal to bear that image, his refusal to follow God's character and God's desires. God tells us how he's going to fix the problem in Genesis 3:15 and 3:16. There is a promised seed of the woman who is coming, who will crush the head of the serpent, the antagonist of the story. He will restore rule to God. And he tells us how this solution is coming through a nation. Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, Israel. So all the parts are contributing to this whole, and the story is going to the place where the 3:15 Messiah is going to be, this is Revelation, the end, the 3:15 Messiah is going to be seated on the throne. The word of the Lord will go out through Israel to the nations, and the only people that are living on this earth in the nations are believers. This ultimate end game, everyone who exists is a believer, submits to the Lord, and God has his hierarchy, his 3:15 ruler, Jesus the Christ, and his word is going out through that nation, Israel. Now, when we come to this chapter, Genesis chapter 34, you may have noticed already last week that it is unusual for the author to include the name of a daughter in a genealogy. Take Genesis 5, for example. When we're tracking the promise, it'll say so-and-so had so-and-so, Enoch, or Lamech, or Methuselah. Oh, by the way, he had other sons and daughters. But we're tracking this one line. We're following where the Christ is coming from, this promise of the one who's going to make everything right. And it's been that way pretty much all the way through. We haven't really had many daughters inserted into the story. Why is that? Is it because the writers are chauvinists or this is a male-dominated society? No. No, it has nothing to do with that. We're tracking a story. And the story is following sons because the 3:15 one is going to be a son. It's coming from this line. So, whenever we noted in Genesis chapter 30, verse 21, that Jacob had a daughter named Dinah, our antennas go up. So, well, this is unusual. This is an anomaly. This is going to have something to do with our story. And the mentioning of Dinah does eventually have an important role, and we find it in chapter 34. What is her role? When she appears again, as Jacob is residing in Shechem, the prince of Shechem, whose name is Shechem, that makes it easy, he rapes her. He takes her by force. Then, the prince and his father approach Jacob because he desires to marry her. He wants this relationship to be permanent. So we find him approaching Jacob. Verse 7, when the sons of Jacob's sons came to the field. Now the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it, that Dinah had been raped. The men were grieved, and they were very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not to be done. We've heard that phrase before, haven't we? Abimelech, such a thing ought not to be done. So it is a familiar phrase. We see this phrase throughout the story, just like we've been tracing other things, like saw it was good in their sight, or journeyed on in a negative direction, or tow the idea of good. So such a thing ought not to be done. Hamor, Shechem's father, spoke with him, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage. Intermarry with us, give your daughters to us, and take our daughters for yourselves. Thus you shall live with us in the land, and the land shall be open before you. Live and trade in it, and acquire property in it." Shechem also said to her father and her brothers, verse 11, "If I find favor in your sight, then I will give you whatever you say to me. Ask me ever so much bridal payment and gift, and I will give according to as you say of me. But give me this girl in marriage." So he's proposing that they intermarry with them. He says, "Look, give me Dinah. Let's make one people," is the idea. "We'll marry your daughters. You'll marry our daughters." You'll see the same idea, this concept, verse 23, verse 16, verse 23, when Shechem is trying to pass the idea off to the rest of the people that live in the city. He says, "Well, not their livestock and their property and all their animals be ours? Only let us consent to them, and they'll live with us. Or Jacob's sons, in verse 16, he says, when they're trying to deceive him, they're saying, well, we will live with you and we will become one people. Now, the question we ask is that good? Is this a good proposition? Would it be a good thing for them to intermarry and become one people at this point in our story with what we've been following? We need to note that we have been tracking two things in this story. First, of course, we're tracking the blessing, right? The lineage of that 315 Messiah. And up to this point in the transition, as we mentioned, it's been fairly linear. We haven't really had to guess. The promise comes from the Genesis 2:24, one man, one woman, one flesh, wife. And unless the author tells us otherwise, so far in the story, it's come from the firstborn. We see in situations like Jacob and Esau, right from the beginning, the author tells us, no, it's going to be the younger, not the older. Look at the younger. But it comes from the 2:24 wife, that is, not Ishmael by Hagar, no, your wife Sarah. From him the promise is going to come. From him will be my covenant. So we've been tracking that one promise all the way up to this point. But secondly, we are tracking a birthright. And when we think birthright, I want you to think land. We're talking about Genesis 15. We're talking about, it's the same as Genesis 12, but 15 makes it very explicit when Abraham is having a covenant cut with him with God, because he's saying, how will I know that I will obtain it, the land? And in verse 18 of chapter 15, we have, on that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants, I have given this land. From the river of Egypt, as far as the great river, the river of the Euphrates, the Kenite, the Kenizzite, the Kadmonite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, Rephaim, Amorite, Canaanite, Girgashite, and Jebusite. So, we have the promise, which is the blessing, and we have the birthright, the inheritance. And the first time we really saw this, it was always unified in an individual. But we saw both elements split up with Jacob and Esau. Esau is the oldest. First, Jacob gets Esau to sell him his birthright for some red stuff that smells good. Esau sells him his inheritance to the land. And then Jacob steals the blessing, which was his all along because God had said it was going to come to him. So we see it split up, but it still remains with Jacob. So now the question is, okay, we've come to these 12 sons of Jacob, and what happens to these two things that we have been tracking? Now I'd say, first, it's important for us to remember, as well on this line of the land, when Abraham is giving, when the promise is falling through Isaac, remember Genesis chapter 25, verse 5 and 6? He eventually has other sons and other daughters with Keturah, right? But he gives them gifts and sends them away. Why? Because the land is Isaac's. They're not to be, it's not their inheritance. And we'll find as the story progresses, Esau leaves the land as well because it belongs to Jacob. We're going to find in 36:6, after their father dies, Esau leaves. The land belongs to Jacob. Now, in Genesis chapter 34, we have a pagan people. They are wanting to intermarry. They are wanting to become one people with Israel. And in doing so, in intermarrying with them, this people who already reside in the land, their property will be ours, right? They will obtain the right to live in the land with them, right? They will intermarry. They will have that right. It will be theirs because they'll be one man, one woman, one flesh. They will be one people. We see God later in the story explicitly warn against the children of Israel not to intermarry with those who are in the land. They're supposed to wipe them out. But right here, we still do see some concern at this point in Genesis. Genesis chapter 24, verse 3. Abraham, when he's charging his servant to go get a wife for his son, he says, I'm going to make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven, and the God of earth, that you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, whom I live. Also, we see that same concern when it comes to Isaac and Jacob. Chapter 28, verse 1. Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said to him, "You shall not take a wife from the daughter of Canaan." Why? Why would it not be good? Well, not only would they become one people, but these are an idolatrous pagan people. That's what becomes a problem later in the story. They're not to intermarry with them because they'll end up going after false gods, their gods, gods in whom there is no deliverance. So they're not to intermarry. We would say in our text today that Jacob's sons were certainly justifiably upset. Their sister has been raped. She's been defiled by this people that they're living by. So they are justifiably upset. Vengeance is, of course, in order and would be proper. But the question is, was the way that they went about obtaining this vengeance acceptable or proper or good? Or was there serious problems with it? Their response to them, you'll find in chapter 34, verses 13 through 17. Jacob's sons answered Shechem and his father Hamor with deceit because they had defiled Dinah, their sister. They said to them, "We cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Only on this condition will we consent to you, if you will become like us, in that every male of you be circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you. And we will take your daughters for ourselves, and we will live with you and become one people. But if you will not listen to us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and we will go." So I say, on this condition, if you will do this, if you will circumcise yourselves, we'll consent. And when they do, it sounds good to Shechem. He goes back to the city. He convinces all the males to do it. After 3 days go by and they are in pain from the circumcision, Simeon and Levi take their sword, they go into the city, and they slaughter every man in the city, and then they take everything they have there as plunder. They used the covenant sign of circumcision. They treated it as something that is common, they treated it in a blasphemous way, and they used it as a means of warfare and deceit, of taking vengeance. Now, we've already seen people take vengeance in the story that wasn't due to them, like Lamech, right? We're supposed to be waiting for the 315 one to come. Vengeance is his to dole out. But here, we do have this special people of God. You would think it's in order, but it's the way they go about it. Was that good? Well, if you're reading a novel and you're wanting to know why this particular chapter or what's going on in this part of the book, you say, "Well, I'm not really sure I know what's going on here." You could cheat, right? You could just flip on over to the end of the book and say, "Okay, I just want to know what happens. Tell me what this is." And you say, "Oh, okay, I see what they're doing here. It makes sense. I've gone to the end of the book. The reveal has happened. I know why that character, that shady guy, was hanging around in that scene. He did it." Well, whenever we get in a place in the Bible and we're not sure about something, we can also cheat. We can just go to the end of the story and say, "Well, what does God say about this?" So that's what I want to do here. If you'll turn briefly to Genesis chapter 49, we're going to go to the end of the story. We're going to say, what does the author think about this? What is he doing? Look at Genesis chapter 49, and we will find that the story is heading towards a blessing. It's heading towards the blessings from Jacob. Starting in verse 1, Jacob summoned his sons and said, "Assemble yourselves that I may tell you what will befall you in the days to come. Gather together and hear, O sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. Uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch." Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are implements of violence. "Let my soul not enter into their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly, because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce. And in their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob. I will scatter them in Israel. Last time we mentioned our camera was currently on Reuben, because as we're following the story and we are tracing the promise, we notice the promise comes from that 224 wife, one man, one woman, one flesh, and unless we are told otherwise, we're watching the first son of that 224 wife. So Jacob's 224 wife was Leah, his first wife, and his first son is Reuben. The author is telling us here, chapter 49, there's some events that take place in chapter 35. Reuben sleeps with a covenant mother, Bilhah, one of his father's concubines. He sleeps with her. You're out, Reuben. The blessing's not coming through you. That's it for you. So we're not following Reuben anymore. The author's told us the camera is not sticking with him. We're going to have a hint in 35 to say that, but it's a confirmation in chapter 49. Now, if it's not coming through Reuben, where does the camera go? Who's the next one that would naturally fall in line? Well, it would be Simeon. Simeon is the second born. And the author's saying, no, not Simeon. He treated the covenant sign of circumcision as common. He's out. What about Levi? No. Levi is out too. So who are we going to watch? Judah. It goes to Judah. Look at chapter 49, verse 8. Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hands shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion. And as a lion, who dares to rouse him up? Now notice verse 10. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh, that is, he whose right it is to rule, it is a kingly promise, the ruler's staff will not pass from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. He ties his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are dull from wine, his teeth white from milk. The promise goes to Judah. We are tracking the Messiah through Judah at this point in the story. So, when we go back to 34 and we say, why is Dinah here? Is it some just strange inclusion? No, it's an absolute necessity in the story because it's telling us how Simeon and Levi knocked themselves out of the line of having the Messiah come through them. The blessing's not coming through them because of this action. And according to chapter 35, verse 22, Reuben's action there, it came about while Israel was dwelling in the land that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. Reuben's out too. Everything in the story is in the story because it pertains to the story. And the story is about Jesus, this one that's coming, this Messiah. Now, the question arises then at this point, why doesn't the story stop around chapter 35's end or 36 even? Because if you look at the end of chapter 35, Benjamin is born, which is the 12th son of Jacob. Rachel dies in the process. But we have this listing again, starting at the end of verse 22. Here were the 12 sons of Jacob. Lists out the 12 sons of Jacob. Isaac dies. Jacob and Esau bury him. Seems like a nice place to tie things up, right? We have the 12 sons whom the 12 tribes of Israel are going to come from, who are going to make up the nation. And then if we wanted to continue a little bit farther, it just talks about Esau and his generation. So we have an idea to work with when they're going into the land. Why doesn't it stop there? Well, the reason it continues on is we don't just need a physical set of 12 individuals that come from Jacob. They need to have faith in God and faith in the promised seed who will deliver them. They need to have reverence for this one. And they don't. They have no reverence for the seed, no respect for the seed. They don't care about it. Just like we saw Abraham and God work in his life, just like we saw Isaac, and at the end he blesses Jacob, says he will be blessed. Just like we saw Jacob sent down to Laban, now God's going to work on the 12 tribes, or the 12 sons of Israel who will be the 12 tribes. They have to have hope in the promise as well. They have to have faith in God as well, because they're supposed to bring the message of the Messiah to the nations. So they have to be believing. And that's why the story is going to continue on. We're going to watch God shape their faith, and God is going to use Joseph to do this, the youngest one. Turn over to chapter 38 with me, and we will deal with this second chapter for today. We know that ultimately Judah is going to receive the blessing. What is the state of Judah's heart right now? Well, for starters, he did sell his brother into slavery in chapter 37. His brothers were conspiring as to what to do with Joseph. They threw him in a well rather than kill him. And Judah says, shouldn't we profit off this ordeal? Look, here's some traitors coming. Let's sell them off. So he's conspiring to sell his brother. We know that much. And when you look at the first two verses of chapter 38, we find out Judah saw a certain daughter, verse 2, of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her and went into her. He has a Canaanite for a wife. Judah is not in line with what his patristic forefathers would have wanted. He's taking a Canaanite and intermarrying with them. So we have a problem here. Now, Judah has three sons from this wife. He has he has Onan, and he has Shelah. If this Canaanite, Shua, is his 224 wife, and the promise is coming through Judah, where does the camera go? Firstborn son, The camera says, boom, this must be where the promise is coming from. But doesn't last long in the story. If you just read briefly, chapter 38, we'll find that verse 6, Judah took a wife for his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord took his wife. So God kills but has already married. He already has his one man, one woman, one flesh wife. So what does that mean for Tamar? Well, it means Tamar has a right to the promise. She is one flesh with They are viewed as the same. She has a right, a right for the birthright to come through her. Within the custom, Judah tells his next offspring, Onan, to go into Tamar so that she can raise up children for But Onan doesn't want to do that. He'll go and he'll go into her, but he doesn't want to give her his seed. He wastes it on the ground. And in doing so, he is treating as common the promised seed, that line. So guess what? God kills Onan. Onan's off the scene, which leaves Shelah, Judah's last son. And at this point, Judah doesn't want to give him to Tamar because he's worried that Shelah will die. And he tells Tamar, go to your father's house. Shelah's, he's a young lad. When he gets a little bit older, then I'll let him raise up children for you in that way. So she goes off. Time passes. Nothing. She's just staying in her father's house, waiting, and it becomes evident that Judah is not going to give her Shelah. So what is Tamar to do? Well, she finds out after Tamar's wife, Shua, has died, Tamar and one of his old buddies, this Adullamite, they're going to go have a good time. They're going to go sheave some sheep. They're going to, it's just his old buddy, they're going to go get into trouble. And she dons harlot robes. She says, if you won't give me the seed, I'm going to take the seed. So she goes. She presents herself as a harlot on the side of the road. And of course, Judah, with his heart being in the state that it is, turns aside to her and negotiates to have relations with this woman he suspects to be a harlot. She negotiates for some sort of a pledge to make sure that he's going to pay her. And she gets his signet ring. She gets his cord. She gets his staff. She says, let me hold on to these, and you can go home and get my payment and bring it back to me, and then I'll give you your signet ring, your staff, all that back. Seems good to Judah. He goes into her. He leaves. Sends his buddy, the Adullamite, to go pay for her, but she's nowhere to be found. says, okay, well, no big deal then, right? No harm, no foul. Life goes on. Until word gets around that his daughter-in-law, Tamar, is pregnant. How could this be? He hasn't given her Shua. She doesn't have the freedom to marry outside of the family. She has played the harlot. So Judah decides, I'm going to have you burned. Death for this harlotry. And as they're pulling her to do this, she sins and gets her the cord and the staff and the signet ring. Asks Judah, tell me, do you recognize these? Where do they come from? And it's at that point that it dawns on Judah what has taken place. And at the end of the story, we find that Judah declaring that she is more righteous than I. What is that about? Why is Tamar more righteous than Judah in this situation? Go ahead and look at the last four verses of chapter 38. This is the birth of the child that Tamar has conceived. She's conceived twins. It came about at the time she was giving birth that, behold, there were twins in her womb. Moreover, it took place while she was giving birth. One put out his hand. The midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, this one came out first. But it came about as he drew back his hand that, behold, his brother came out. Then she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. So he was named Perez. Afterward, his brother came out who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah. Keep that in mind and turn to Ruth chapter 4. Ruth chapter 4. Ruth chapter 4, in the last four verses, we have a very special genealogy that gives us the reason for the writing of the book of Ruth. Listen to this. Now, these are the generations of Perez. To Perez was born Hezron, and to Hezron was born Ram, and to Ram Amminadab, and to Amminadab was born Nahshon, and to Nahshon Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz, and to Boaz Obed, and to Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse David. Tamar's child from Judah is the messianic line, the seeds passing through. David ultimately comes from that union. So when we look in the story and he's saying, you are more righteous than I, there's only one way that you're righteous at any point in the story. Abraham was righteous. He walked with God. Noah walked with God. He was in line with God. He had hope in the 3:15 promise. Righteousness only comes that way. That one who's going to come, the 3:15 one. Tamar has regard for the blessing. Judah has no regard. She is righteous. That's the only way you're tracking this story, is lining up with God's desires. That's the only way we're tracking. This story is about one thing. It's that hope for that one who's going to come and make it right. And that's what we're seeing in this story. So by the end of this episode, we see this movement in Judah. We do see him concede, you are more righteous. You're searching for this. But he is not there yet. God still has work to do in his heart. So we're going to watch through the Joseph narrative next week. Judah in the background, becoming a great man of faith. We're going to watch him completely reverse his role, which he had in Joseph's expulsion to Egypt, as we track this story. And by the time we get to the Exodus, we're going to have 12 brothers who believe in the promise, who are in Egypt, who are fruitful and multiplying. And that's where the book of Genesis is going to cut it off. So we're following Jacob. We're following his sons as they're placing their faith in the promise. We're not trying to figure out how each chapter is about us. Or we're not trying to figure out how we can take some principle out of the text and apply it to my life, or how I can, as far as though that's all that's there. It is to you. And there are all kinds of imperatives in the story that are directly to you. But the story is about Christ. I'm not just trying to use it as a self-help. We're not just trying to make our life better this week. We are looking for the one who has the life. And through our relationship with him, we have the life. That's what the story is about. That's what this life is about. It's about knowing that one. So I hope as we're going through this story, you're starting to feel the same way that these Israelites are feeling, where we're hoping, when is it going to come? When is this one going to arrive? Are you coming yet? Because things are just getting worse and worse. But he came, right? He came in history. We are so fortunate to live on this side of the line. Well, we know that he came. His name was Jesus. He lived. He died. He was crucified, buried, rose again, as evidence that when he comes back, we'll be resurrected as well through faith in him.